Ooh, hot diggity dog, I'm ready to go. Hello, hello, hello! Cha-da-cha-cha-cha. Me and, what was his name? What was his name? That playwright that wrote all that corny stuff. What was his name? Hello out there. Oh, yes. Rolls Royce, of course. Yeah. No. Wait a minute. What, wasn't he, Lithuanian, yeah, he was a Lithuanian playwright. Cha-cha-cha-cha-cha. All right, all together. Oh, that's enough. It's the beginning of the week. And when you begin a week, you must begin a week with a secret pledge to yourself that this week will be better, cleaner, straighter, more official, more successful than last week. Right, gang? And also, keep remembering this. There is no rest for the wicked. You remember that one, too. And, I don't know what else to tell you to remember. After that, there's nothing else to remember. But let's clean up everything here. Let's get everything straightened away. And now let's begin by a serious move in this new week. Bring it on there. Hello, testing? Hello? There, I'm coming through. Hello. Hey, do you ever read Russell Baker at all? You should. Once in a while, Baker comes off with a really gassy one. And a couple of weeks ago, when I first spotted this one in the Times, I thought, he's the first guy who's made that point. You know, you don't bite the hand that feeds you very often. And, by the way, Skip, I must admit, I do like fig bars. And there's an old slogan out in Indiana that says that a man who likes fig bars can't be all bad. That's true. That is an old Indiana slogan, and I happen to like fig bars. You know, you can get raspberry fig bars, which is kind of a paradox for me when you think about it. You can get blueberry fig bars. You can get cheese fig bars. Have you seen those? Ugh. If you're really far out, or if you're a conventionalist, I suppose you could call it a traditionalist, a classicist, you can get fig bars, if you really want to stick with it. So I want to salute the fig bar out there. You know, there's some things, when you think about it, though, if I can digress here for a minute, there are some things that are so interwoven in your life, so completely, that they are sort of as natural to your life as shoes. You never think about them. Fig bars are one of them. I mean, there must have been a guy at one point in history who invented the first fig bar. And there's something about the fig bar that has made it universal ever since that. In fact, I've seen fig bars, you know, these little Fig Newton packages. I've seen them in little stands for sale in places like Nigeria. And the fig bar is universal. Here's another thing that's universal. Tomato soup. Absolutely a universal dish. Now, you hear people always talk about, oh, yes, but Maxime's has such wonderful onion soup, and so on. Or people will talk about, ah, but the Vichyssoise, and they'll go on and on. You hardly ever hear anybody say, oh, man, oh, boy, Charlie's Diner on Route 3 has the greatest tomato soup. It's just taken for granted. Tomato soup is something nobody ever talks about. And when they do, they always seem to talk about Campbell's. You know, there's other kinds of tomato soup. Now, here's another thing that's a universal thing that ever since I was a little kid, and I imagine this goes back, in fact, to be scholarly about it, and I don't think this is truly scholarly, but to be more or less objective about it, this next thing that I just thought of probably goes back a couple of thousand years. Root beer. You never hear anybody talk about root beer. And yet, root beer is universal. It's everywhere. And by the way, I happen to be a real root beer nut. I love great root beer, don't you? I mean, you know, you talk all you want about Coke and all that stuff, but ultimately, when the chips are down, root beer goes all the way. I mean, really good root beer. And I'm not going to give you a commercial because I'm not even going to mention the name, but recently a company here in New York City, I couldn't believe it, or at least I guess they're in New York City, came out with a root beer, this draft root beer, that goes, it's the ultimate root beer. I'm telling you, it's fantastic. I couldn't believe it. So, I mean, it's like suddenly somebody coming out with a new dimension in fig bars. You can't believe they could be any better, but there it is. There are other things, too, that are universal like that we don't talk about, and I think that's one of them, the root beer. Hot dogs. That's very universal. They eat hot dogs in Munich. Let's see, what else is another universal thing? I mean, that is never mentioned. Now, a lot of things are constantly advertised, so hence they're self-conscious. Beer. Beer is advertised all over the place. You don't hear many root beer ads, nor do you hear any announcers coming on, you know, the big 60-second shot in the middle of the Tonight Show on film, you know, with 17 actresses doing a thing for fig bars. You know, they come out dancing and all carrying big fig bars and all this. The fig bar is there. That's the end of it. Pancakes is another universality. And that we all eat pancakes. Sometimes, more or less. And yet, that's a universal thing. And are there any commercials about camp? Now, even Aunt Jemima, they don't even have, oh, that kid. Every time I think of that Aunt Jemima kid, the one that says, oh, can Aunt Jemima make cinnamon sticks? Ooh, I want to smash him in the mouth. Shh, that kid with the toaster. But you notice they don't talk about their pancakes. Just a universal. Speaking of universals, and as long as we're on that subject, the reason I brought up Russell Baker, there are certain guys who do things day after day after day, and nobody says anything about it. You know, just there. And they may be saying 50 times more than the famous writers, like, guys that get all the credit, like Buchwald, who's never did much for me or to me, and everybody talks about him. Guys like Baker, day after day after day, maybe it's because they don't bend towards the cutie pie. You'll find that most writers that get a lot of attention make sure that they're on television a lot, and they also make sure that they run heavily to the cutie pie stuff, and that's with Buchwald. But nevertheless, here's a thing that Baker did the other day, and I ripped this thing out, and I said to myself, well. I don't often quote other writers or other people, primarily because I've got my own work to do. Baker doesn't quote me very much. But I felt that what he said, coming from a guy in the industry, is very interesting because it's something that's rarely talked about. And it is what I like to call, and he doesn't mention it here, he doesn't really put it, pinpoint it, because he's really doing a takeoff here on hippies, but what I have noticed, and I think you have too, is the interview explosion. It seems like the whole world is either being interviewed or is interviewing. And there's a little tiny minority, apparently, of people who sit and watch the interviews or listen to them. It's incredible. The interview explosion has become almost epidemic. And nobody talks about it. In fact, it provides almost the total backbone of the entire entertainment industry. If you're going to be honest about it, you will realize most of the shows that you watch that you think are so great, people don't tap dance. They don't sing. Once in a while, somebody will get up and just to give everybody a rest, will sing a tune. They don't play nose flutes. They are interviewed. And so you'll see the opening of the Tonight Show in here. And now, here he is, Johnny Carson himself. And don't forget, tonight's guest will be Zsa Zsa Gabor, Monty Rock, and also, of course, Bertrand Russell will be on hand. And what is it? It's a long, involved interview. And they sit, and one after the other, they talk about their newest picture, their newest record, their newest shtick that they're selling. And that really is the basis of the show, interviews. You never thought of the Tonight Show as an interview show. Well, that's really what it is. And you'll notice that as the interviewer tires of the interviewee, or his somehow somebody gets mad at him on the staff, you know, you'd be surprised how much of this is personal, the staff that books him, you'll notice that he will go down in declining order as each show. So the cast-offs of the Johnny Carson show are on the Merv Griffin show. And then when they're really in trouble, then they'll be on the Mike Douglas show. And then finally, the last gasp, you'll see them briefly on the Woody Woodbury show, and the last moment, they're probably out to sea somewhere. So, you know, if you see this declining hierarchy of the interviews, speaking of the declining... Oh, this is...
This is KRAB, Seattle.
And don't forget, this week, I will be live as a bird down at the Limelight, and... For those of you who probably got all balled up over the past weekend, it was not a live show this past weekend, but I will be live this week down at the Limelight. And if you'd like to get your reservations, and by the way, because of the holiday season coming up and a lot of kids are home for weekends and that this time, it's very wise to call early in the week for your reservation. Because a lot of people are coming in from all over, and if you want to come down this weekend, you better call them at Oregon 52212 tonight, now, and get set for this coming weekend. That is the Limelight. And let's see, what else do we have? We have Christmas Fund. I hope you're getting your quarter in the mail to the Christmas Fund here, WR Children's Christmas Fund, Box 710, Times Square Station, okay? And let's see. I did the station break already. I told them that. Who they're listening to. They've had that drilled into their skull enough. And let's see, one more thing. Oh, yes, listen, I've got to get this out of the way, too. I don't know why. I can't explain this to myself or to anybody around me, and nobody's been able to explain it to me. I cannot understand why I persistently get letters from people, sometimes maybe as many as 8 or 9 or 10 a day, letters from people who say this, Dear Mr. Shepherd, I understand your book is now out in paperback. Please write to me and tell me where I can get it. I can't understand that because it's in every Greyhound bus station in West Virginia. As far as I know, they're selling it in gas stations outside of Pitcairn, Pennsylvania. It's in every drugstore. If you can't get it at your local drugstore or your local bookshop, just figure you won't be able to buy anything there. Give up on that guy. It's Bantam Books. The title is In God We Trust. All others pay cash, and I don't want to talk about that problem. One guy wrote, I had a great letter from one guy, though. He wrote, and he said he bought 50 copies in the paperback, and he says he's giving them as gifts to people. And he says, I'm giving them these gifts to let them know how it is. And he didn't explain it to me. Now, was he putting me down or what? What do you mean, no? Listen, the put-down is a subtle art form, my dear. I mean, it has many ramifications. Speaking of ramifications, I want to go back to this interview explosion, because nobody talks about this. It's just taken for granted so much today. In fact, I don't know whether the average listener out there or the average viewer realizes that the interview has become, along with the automobile industry, along with the steel industry, one of the four or five major industries in America, employing numbers of people, numbers of hours, and it's a whole big new thing. And many of the people that you find that are being interviewed have no other qualifications in except that they're good interviewers. That's all. Oh, have you ever wondered what some of these people do? Have you ever actually seen Zsa Zsa Gabor act? Well, I mean, let's face it. And so the whole business of being an interviewee has become a specific part of show biz. Now, there is also a sub. Now, this is none of this stuff, by the way, is from Russell Baker's column. This is all my own comment here, but it's a comment. It's an informed comment from someone within the business. Another subdivision of the interview racket is the celebrity guest panelist. Now, that's a subdivision. Now, this is always composed of people who once did something, like once they were a comic, or one time many years ago they did a stage play, or years before they were once in the movies, and now they're constantly on the daytime shows. And you know who I'm talking about. There are dozens and dozens of these people, and they have the automatic smile, and they play games. They're constantly hitting the ding-dong or guessing the whoopee or playing the celebrity quiz or whatever it happens to be, and their job is to be on the panel. That's it. They're panelists. I wonder whether or not the U.S. Department of Labor has designated panelists now as an official occupation. Well, I would think that a person would be a panelist. It would be an occupation because many of the people I know who are official panelists no longer do the thing that they once achieved a minor celebrity in. Most of them never really were particularly successful in the field that they originally got their little fame in. And so now they're eternally panelists. You've noticed that, Skip? Now that's a subdivision. Now that's not to be confused with the interviewer or the interviewee. Now, I wonder how many people have begun to realize that being an interviewer is also part of show business. And so you have different types of interviewers, and they play various roles, and it may be very much at diverse odds to the way they really are. They are really playing a role as much as, let's say, Laurence Olivier is playing a role when he's Hamlet. I'm sure that Olivier in his normal life doesn't go around saying, oh, to be or not to be, that's the question. Oh, God. No, not at all. So you find various types of interviewers. Now, the top, probably the most spectacular kind of interviewer today is the blunt instrument interviewer. So he'll say, he'll start out on, today, ladies and gentlemen, our guest is Professor Charles L. Watanabe, who has written a book on the population explosion in Peru and is a world-famous economist. And now here is Professor Watanabe. Glad to see you on the show.
I'm certainly delighted to be here, and I'm pleased and honored that you have invited me on the program.
Professor Watanabe, has anyone told you you're a fink? Okay. You know who that could be. Now, that is a specific type of, now he's assuming a role, which is the blunt instrument role. Now, there is another kind of role, and that is the embattled conservative. Now, the embattled conservative is the one, as we know, we're living in a society today where almost everybody mouths liberal cliches of one kind or another. They're pro-civil rights, they're pro-poverty, they're anti-Vietnam War. This has become a great, almost an overweening position of cliche. So he then takes the opposite stand, which is to say, I say what we ought to do in Vietnam is bomb them. And now a word from our sponsors. Now that's a position. That is also part of the show because everybody's mad, see. Now, the interesting thing about this type of showbiz is that a lot of people who listen think that by getting mad and turning this guy off, they are doing him a disservice. As a matter of fact, that's exactly what he's doing it for. The more people are angry, the more... You see, he does not play for applause. Now, the older people, older types of showbiz played for applause, approval. Well, there's a new type of showbiz that plays for disapproval, because they found that active disapproval is as effective as active approval. This is a new slant in showbiz. Now, then there's the other type of interviewer, and that is the bruised sensibility interviewer. That's another kind. He's the kind who plays sensitive person, and he's always saying, "Do you mean to tell me, Professor? You can't tell me that there are people today who feel..." Well, that's the bruised sensibility. That could be called the David Susskind syndrome. There are various types and categories, but the fascinating side of the business is not the interviewers, but the interviewees. And the interviewees, almost to a man, no matter what it is that they're involved in, have an infinite number of press agents and agents who arrange these various interviews. And you'll find, if you go over the dial, both radio and TV, you'll find that the same guys keep popping up on all the different shows. And so you go across the dial, you'll hear one guy on Station X, you'll hear him, and then at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, an hour later, you'll hear him on Station Y, and then you'll hear him on Station D, and all up and down. Then that night, he'll be on the Woody Show, or the Freddie Show, or the Jackie Show, or the Billy Show, or whatever it is on TV. And it's a regular... And now, another part of the interviewer thing, and perhaps that you're not aware of, is it's a national thing that the interviewers... And suddenly you'll notice an interviewee, rather, not interviewer, but the interviewee, you'll notice the interviewee will disappear suddenly. He'll be gone. Well, now, if you were up in Boston, you'd find him all over the dial up there. And then he'll disappear from Boston. And then, boom, he's all over the dial in Cleveland or Pittsburgh. And then finally, he works his way to the coast and then works his way back. And by the time he gets back to New York, 6 months later, he's another fresh face. And he's got a new record. He's got a new shtick. He's got a new ding-dong or a new thing he's selling, whatever it might be. He's got a whole series of new gags and new little funny things to talk about, his new tie he's wearing, the new way he's got his hair cut and all that stuff. And this is a side issue, and it's a new kind. It's a spin-off of the population and or interview. I think it has to do with the population explosion. It's another thing. And or interview explosion, which is going on all over. Now, here's what Russell Baker says about it. Now, I wonder whether many people who are outside know that many things have been totally created by the press. Almost totally. Now, once you create a thing, this is the curious side issue of that, once you create a thing, it quite often becomes a reality. In other words, I've seen records. Hey, is this boring you? Is this the interesting? I've seen a record. I saw an incident one time occur. Now, it happens many times. Now, this happens to have been one that I was right there when I saw it happen. I saw a guy create and it was done as a matter of business. He created a record that had not been existed. Of course, it was going to exist. They planned to cut a record. So they began this tremendous campaign on this record. It was not even cut. And the record, the campaign rose to a crescendo. And all of a sudden, the record appeared on the bestseller charts. It was not even published, not even out. And the minute that it got out, of course, was that all the DJs all across the country played the record because they saw it on the charts, and then it became a genuine bestseller, hit record. So quite often, has it occurred to you that this could very well have been the case with the hippies? No, I'm not being funny. I'm being quite serious. That you know that today, hardly any thing that happens in fashions or the beautiful world or the turned-on world will immediately become part of a front-page story in Time, Life, you name it. Well, large numbers, I'd say most people in our country today, in fact, I say this is in most countries, most people today are followers. Very few people are anything but that. And so they will be, they'll be following Timothy Leary, or they follow Krasner, or Bob Dylan or Woody Allen, whoever it might be. They're just terribly involved. Now, they would never recognize themselves as fans. The only people who are fans are Doris Day. If you happen to be hung on Doris Day, or if you're hung on Tab Hunter, or if you're hung on somebody like Cary Grant, then you're just a fan. But if you're hung on, say, somebody like Timothy Leary, you're not a fan. You are a believer in this fantastic philosophy and blah, 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 blah. Well, I wonder how much of this stuff has been originally created, because these guys made a good interview, and the next thing you know, thousands of people began to emulate this, and then it became a reality. The thing which was discussed originally as a reality but wasn't became that. Now, here's what Baker says. Hate Street, the world capital of Hippieville, has a new problem. It is now threatened by a severe shortage of hippies. With the cold weather coming on, a lot of hippies went home or south for the winter. The rise of violence and the hippies' biggest business, the dope trade, scared out a lot of others. The result is that there are nowhere nearly enough hippies left to meet the enormous continuing demand for interviews. This becomes obvious when you go out, and by the way, he wrote this from San Francisco. He says, this becomes obvious when you go out to Hate Street to obtain the standard interview with a hippie that is de rigueur for all journalists passing through San Francisco. Every hippie you approach on the street with a request for an interview gives you the same reply. And you have an appointment, man? If you haven't, there is an average wait of 10 days to 2 weeks. Even then, the hippies will probably be able to give you no more than 15 minutes of his time. Man, I've been so over-interviewed in the past month that I haven't had time to turn on for a week, said one harassed hippie. This girl had just finished a two-hour interview with a sociologist from Arkansas who was doing a monograph on the relationship between bare feet and cold sidewalks and was rushing off to be interviewed by reporters from a North Dakota newspaper for a series to be called Our Children in Dirt. A bare-chested hippie in a fetching laughing boy coiffure stood outside Melvin Pivnik's House of Euphoria in deep depression. Unless the colleges of America start turning out three times as many hippies as they're now producing, he predicted, this country's newspapers, magazines, psychiatrists, sociologists, and TV commentators are simply not going to be able to keep the country properly alarmed. He was promptly led off by an interviewer from Fortune, gathering material for an article on the economics of the underground press. One pitiable little lad of a hippie, hunkered barefooted on the curb, seemed free. When approached, however, he appeared to be in a trance of some sort. What's the idea of disturbing our hippie? Demanded an angry man in a three-button suit. He, it turned out, was part of a team from the University of Ashtabula, which was working on effects of marijuana baked into ginger snaps. We got exclusive interview rights with this hippie for the next 2 weeks. Scram, buddy, go find your own hippie. Dreadful scenes were evident at every corner. On one, a team of still photographers from an illustrious magazine that dealt in fashions was battling a team of movie photographers from an awesome network for possession of a huge hippie with hair like Elsa Lancaster's in The Bride of Frankenstein. At another, an undernourished hippie was trying to resist a newspaper interviewer from Vermont. I've already done 18 interviews today, he shrieked. I can't go on. Pull yourself together, man, urged another hippie from the clutches of a South Carolina socio-psychiatrist. Remember, you're a hippie. Try to act like one. Surveys show that every hippie on Hate Street is now being subjected to a minimum of 11 interviews a day, not including the interviews conducted for surveys to determine how many times hippies are interviewed daily. A different set of surveys shows that 97 out of every 100 hippies are so confused by the middle of the interview day that they're telling interviewers just anything at all, just to be shed of them. The question is how much longer the hippies can go on if they do not receive fresh replacements soon. They are struggling gamely to continue ministering to the nation's need for alarming situation reports, but they are obviously not keeping up with demand. Unless something is done soon, there will not be a hippie left in the Hate capable of giving an interview. If that is permitted to happen, we might all have to start looking around the house for phenomena to keep us assured that the country is in bad shape. What fun is that? Now, this is a very funny piece. I mean, if you read it in one way, but it's quite true. Now, I guess most people reading this would think this is an exaggeration. They would laugh about it. And yet, I know that visiting teams of hippies who travel from college to college and are booked through agents who are then, they do an evening then. They stand on the stage and they answer questions about being a hippie. And in fact, I just did a show at a college up in the northern part of the state, in New York State. The campus was a buzz. And when I arrived, there was a lot of talk, and everybody was there, and they were asking me what I thought of these guys, and I happened to know two of them, and they asked me, well, we understand you know so-and-so, and they mentioned, I said, yeah, well, he's a pro. These kids were thrown. What do you mean, pro? I said, well, he's a professional hippie, that he is on the hippie circuit, and he's working the circuit, and next week he'll be at the University of Pitcairn, and the week after that he'll be at the Indiana School of Psychiatry, and so on, up and down the line, and he's working the hippie circuit. They couldn't believe it. And I said, well, how did you get him? Well, we got him through an agency. And somehow they did not realize that what he was doing was a profession. And he was playing hippie just the way, years ago on the radio, Jack Benny played Stingy Miser. And he was so much part of the bourgeois world that his press agent, everybody traveled with him, and they handed out pictures. They even sold pictures on the campus, and I thought this was of course that is another subdivision of the interview world. Now, how far this will go, I don't know. How long it will continue, I don't know. I suspect that showbiz is outmoded. In fact, I know it's outmoded. That ladies who sing selections from Schubert art songs no longer find a welcome on the campuses. And just a few years ago, there was a thriving industry of what's so-called art, most of it out of the 19th and 18th centuries, really, and the campuses were constantly deluged with tall, thin gentlemen with large amounts of hair who played Chopin. They would have a little tea before that, and the student committee in charge of cultural activities would then take the professor into the auditorium, and he would play his famous version of the Polonaise. This is gone. This is gone and out and has been for a long time. It just took a while for the colleges to realize it. And so now today, if somebody has achieved a minor celebrity through one picture he's painted, he no longer paints. You don't paint after that, because then you're liable to get shot down. If you've once written a little one-act play that appeared at the Armpit Theater above the Pool Hall on 4th Street and that was raved about in the Village Voice or the Village Other, you then stop writing plays instantly because you're liable to get shot down on the next one, and you begin the circuit and you travel around. This is a new cultural phenomenon. I don't think it's really been reported on yet. Baker didn't. He was really taking off on the hippies in his piece, and I'm saying to you right now that within the next few months, I'm sure somebody hearing the show will get an idea, that within the next few months there will be pieces appearing in magazines on the interview explosion, which is becoming epidemic. Remember, you heard it here first. And by the way, the interview has become so important that unless you interview somebody, you're not considered to have done anything. In fact, if you notice that in most radio listings in the newspapers, the New York Times is notably derelict this way. They'll have outstanding radio shows of the week. And if you'll notice, that every show is an interview show. Every last show. Now, that means that if any of the people who are being interviewed were to get their own radio show, they would then cease to be an event. And they're not important any longer. And so you'll find that, people constantly ask me, they say, well, what do you do? Who do you interview? I say, I don't interview anybody. What do you do? I say, well, I entertain. I do things. I mean, what does Mort Saul do? He gets up on a stage. He talks. He entertains people. He doesn't interview people. But somehow that's suspect. And so the interview has become so ubiquitous today that people think in terms of the interview as the basis for every conceivable show or program or what. If Fred Allen were around today, he would have to interview ladies who wrote books on cats. He would just have to. I mean, because he would not be doing a real show unless he did. And so you find this interview thing has become so all-inclusive that it has, in a sense, supplanted the activity that the interviewee originally was doing. Have you wondered how an author can be writing when day after day after day he's on a panel at 2 o'clock in the afternoon hitting the ding-dong or guessing the whoopee? Well, the secret is this, and I guess I might as well get really down to the nitty-gritty of disillusionment, that large numbers of people today who have made a name and are, whatever that name may be, and no longer have the time to do the thing that they originally did, have found that being interviewed is an extremely profitable business. And I'm talking about just the fact that the interviews have become so competitive that interviews today are a main source of income for many of the interviewees, not the interviewer, the interviewees. And so if you can do three or four of these shows a week, now most of the little shows, the little radio shows and so on, pay nothing, but almost invariably the TV shows do. And so a man can travel around this country and appear on TV show after TV show and be in the $150,000 bracket and never write another book. And his book might have sold maybe 12 copies in the original, and gotten bad reviews of that. But he broke through and is now on the interview circuit. Now, that interview circuit, there used to be a version of that, from what I can tell. The old-timers have told me this, that there was a version of that that existed for years, and they called it the ladies' afternoon luncheon circuit. And writers who had long since given up writing, reviewers who no longer reviewed, dancers who no longer danced, and so on, would travel from town to town appearing at luncheons. And they learned to be very, very pleasant and very glib. They knew what made the ladies feel good, and they knew what made them love to have them. And year after year, he went around. I know one man, as a matter of fact, who was quite a successful writer, but he found that he could earn a fabulous income by simply going to luncheon. That's all. And he'd get up and give a little five-minute talk at a luncheon, and he'd earn more money in 1 week doing this than he could earn in his writing for 5 years. So he gave up writing. So he became a visiting writer. Now, that's a capitalized writer. That's in capital letters. And you find this circuit, which is dying because a new breed of ladies are around, and no longer do the ladies put on their funny little hats with the feathers and stuff and go in the afternoon and eat rubber chicken and listen to the man from New York. That is disappearing, and they're getting that out of the tube. They're getting the same scene. And so you find that hundreds of people are in the business today simply to be interviewed. And then again, of course, there's the interviewer's handbook. Do you know about that? That the exchange of information between interviewers is very tight. And so quickly there's phone calls made all over town. This one's a good interviewer. This one's a, and be sure to ask him this. He's got a great bit on that. the exchange of information. And that's why you'll find in so many cases that the questions that are asked are almost the same as they were on the show before that you saw this person. The exchange of information is very tight. There's another thing too, the booking. Now that's another sub-part of the industry. Maybe you don't know that that there are famous people within the industry who do nothing but book interviewees. And they're famous because they know, they, quote, have all the contacts. And they know all the various agents, and they know all the various press agents, and they know all the various interviewees. And so they will travel from show to show. Now, most people don't look at the little print that follows after a TV show. They'll say, "You've been watching the Johnny Show." And then, real quickly, A whole lot of little names will go past. Charlie Gutstop, audio visual effects, you know, Murphy L. Murphy, blah, 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 blah. Well, all those little names, you know, way down at the bottom, it'll say a program consultant, it'll say production assistant, little things like that. Well, those are the people who travel from show to show and work on various different shows all across the country and booking the same people. So it's a fascinating new industry that's grown up. Very little has been written about it, and yet it is probably as influential an industry as we have had in this country in a long time. When I say influential, large numbers of people are quite innocent yet about it. And they'll see this guy interviewing or being interviewed, and they accept it at its face value, not realizing that quite a few things today, which sound like they're serious, it may be a position on Vietnam, it may be a position on peace, it may be a position on whatever happens to be currently the big interviewing topic at that time, is purely a contrived and worked out position that ensures that this person will be always interviewed. It's like a singer. Years ago, you know, a singer had to keep abreast. He had to sing what was latest material. He had to keep abreast. And so no matter how big the singer was, every day, part of his day, would be spent in listening to new songs and selecting material, because he had to keep au courant. He had to keep continuing to be part of the changing taste in music. Well, that was a recognized thing, and it's certainly legitimate. But has it occurred to you that interviewees do much the same thing? And so have you noticed that those that just last season were tremendously involved in civil rights now suddenly have switched to Vietnam, and they'll switch to something else in a year or two? You find that those... Have you noticed that experts, too, do that? And so when the subject of being angry about the automobile industry has run its course, then you become angry about hamburger. anger is a saleable commodity like sex and must be continually changed, because the public's taste in anger or concern changes, just as it changes in popular music or jokes or books. And so you'll find that interviewees today, a really big, solid interviewee even has two or three writers who create often his stance, who look for materials and statistics, bits and pieces of information which he can add to his repertoire to make his stand appear more valid, more interesting. How about that? We're in interesting times, gang. Hang loose, hang loose. And don't forget who tomorrow's guest is going to be. It's going to be exciting.